Number one, we were looking for places where there was a strong hope to make change. And so I think that having that, we see that in each of these communities, and we're excited to be a part of that. I mean, I think it's so just cool to think that we can be there learning alongside them as they figure out how to make this work and how to make their communities healthier.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hawk Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Earlier this month, the Hawk Foundation officially announced the grantees of its new Collaborative Approaches to Well-Being in Rural Communities initiative, which aims to support rural communities in their efforts to collaboratively and inclusively transform the environments where people live, learn, work, play, and pray, to support resilience, mental health, and well-being. That's a mouthful. A total of about $2 million was awarded to organizations in five rural communities in Texas: Bastrop, Brooks, Morris, Nacogdoches, and Victoria counties. Well before we knew who any of these grantees would be, there was a sense that this new initiative would be a milestone for the foundation, marking our strategic shift away from mental illness at the individual level toward mental health at the community level, and perhaps for mental health in Texas. Here to talk to us about what it means are Tammy Hines and Ricky Barra, program officers for the Hawk Foundation. Rick and Tammy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ike.
So we've already said quite a bit about this new grant initiative and its focus on rural communities. Understanding the goals of this initiative, from your point of view, what are we trying to accomplish and what do you see as your role in that?
Well, I'm gonna jump in and just say that I think that what we want to accomplish is to bring people together in these rural communities, particularly people who have not been at the table, so to speak, prior to this, and people that often their voices aren't heard. And we find a sincere amount of value in hearing from people who have opinions, have wants and needs, and a lot of times those opinions, wants and needs are not part of the broader discussion. And so we really want to encourage and support these communities that we've selected to reach out and find these people and to figure out a way to bring them into the fold and to, you know, figure out how they can have some of these really challenging conversations. We know there's a lot of potential barriers. We know there's a lot of potential tension in communities where we want this to occur. And yet we have a lot of hope that by coming together and building collaborations and really recognizing what the strengths are in each of these communities, that they can individually, meaning individual communities, can individually work toward the well-being of the community.
Yeah, and I will just add to what Tammy mentioned. I think one of our goals is really to support communities in developing a stronger sense of social connectedness and supports, stronger sense of family, stronger sense of neighborhood, stronger sense of community. We believe that that health really starts at home. Again, very different from our history of funding programs and services, where we're really trying to bring our work into community level participation. And so I think, you know, again, all this really is aligned with our overall goal about supporting resilience, mental health, and well-being.
Okay, so Rick, at the same time, as we've been talking about this new initiative, we've been saying a lot about our new strategic direction. For our audience, can you break down what is truly new about the approach that we're taking?
Yeah. Well, I think HOG is like most foundations. You know, grant making is really kind of more project or service focused. For example, you know, funding integrated healthcare sites or funding peer specialists or training in trauma-informed care, et cetera. So it's really project or initiative-based. We're making a huge pivot to take our work, what we call upstream, for communities to really examine and address root causes that contribute to health inequities. We want to support communities to convene, to define their own priorities, to create their own success indicators and implement activities and strategies designed to achieve their goals.
Okay. And so it's not just that there's a change in what we're doing, but how we're doing it.
Yeah, right. And I think one of the challenges for a lot of foundations who are interested in doing this work is that this work is long term. You know, these kinds of goals cannot be accomplished in 1 year or 2 years or even 3 years. So I think, you know, in light of some of the foundations that are doing the same type of work, you know, I think we're really invested in doing this long term to supporting communities in terms of achieving these goals.
So we're not just changing what we're doing, but how we're doing it. And I think a great example is the technical assistance provided to the organizations who we invited to apply for this. Can you explain what that is and why it was useful to us and the grantees?
Well, I think when we first started planning this whole initiative and we talked about who we really wanted to grant, who was our ideal grantee, we were really hoping to reach rural communities that didn't have a lot of resources. And so part of our discussion was around how can we access those communities? And then if they don't have the traditional resources to write a grant, to, you know, have, maybe they don't have a development person within their community, or they don't have a grant writer, they don't have somebody that could even focus on that, how can we support that? And, you know, we were really thinking that many of the communities that we would want to try to get to might need support in terms of figuring out how do you respond to a grant and how do you tell your story. And so at that point, we felt like since we were going to do a request for letters of interest, which has two phases, where people submit a general letter basically telling us what they're envisioning, and then if we feel like that's strong enough, then we come back and request a full proposal from them. And we felt like at that point, once we requested a full proposal, we wanted to offer technical assistance, support in terms of how to develop that proposal. And we wanted to do it equitably. So we offered that to all of the candidates. There were 20 at that point. We offered all 20 up to 5 hours of a consultant's time. His name is Charlie Scarborough, and he did a fabulous job. He basically met with each of the potential applicants and really worked with them to craft their responses to our proposal. He identified, you know, through his conversations with them, maybe they would tell him kind of a side note about something, and he realized that actually needed to be a key part of their story, for instance. And so we felt like they were getting great support and technical assistance that can last them well beyond this particular grant proposal.
The only thing I'll add is that we had never done anything like this before. So this was a first for us. And what you find is that a lot of foundations, they'll actually build that in the front end of providing a grant proposal development training prior to actually announcing an RFP. But for this one, we kind of dropped this technical assistance right in, right after the LOIs, when we selected the letters of interest, inviting them to submit full proposals. That's where we dropped in the technical assistance. And to Tammy's point, we saw a dramatic improvement across the board of all of the letters of interest in terms of, you know, their focus, the strength of their story, and made it a very, very difficult decision Knowing that we could only select five, we would have wanted to select all 20.
Yeah, and I can see how, like, for other funders, it may well be that the grantee's level of resources and sophistication is one of the things that they're actually screening for.
Good point. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And we talked about that. I mean, this is in many ways, this is a big risk for the foundation, which I think is part of the reason that it's so exciting, because we recognized that by potentially funding some of these smaller areas that don't have some of those resources at their fingertips, that they might also not have the financial background, for instance, right, to manage a grant of this size. And we were okay with that. We basically said, that's not going to be a deal breaker for us. Right. We'll figure that out. Because in order to get to the communities that we really wanted to get to, we wanted to have as few barriers as possible for them to apply. And I'll tell you, we've already learned a huge, huge amount, so that if we are ever able to do this again, there are even things we would do differently from the way we did it this time to access different groups. So that's exciting to me too, because this whole process has been a real learning experience for all of us.
Okay, so what are some key milestones for this initiative that the public should be paying attention to?
So I think that question is really kind of tricky. And so I'm gonna answer it this way. I think that there are some high-level expectations that we at the foundation have. We tried very hard to place very few restrictions / expectations on the grantee's design of this. But what those include is we would like there to be a thorough community needs assessment that includes the people who have historically been excluded. We would like for a community collaborative to form that includes those people who have historically been excluded. And we would like the collaborative to determine, after reviewing the community needs assessment, to pull together what is their plan, what is their implementation plan, what are the things that they need to do, and in what order are they thinking that they want to do these to move forward in building resiliency and creating a community that is conducive to mental health and well-being. So those are kind of high-level milestones that over this three-year period, and they're milestones in the sense that they're things we can look at, and yet there's not a time frame, right, a concrete time frame around it. We really wanted to leave that very loose because we recognize how important the relationship development piece of all of this is. And truly, we've said from the beginning, if the relationship development takes the full 3 years and they get to a point where they are solidly together, that's a success.
We're entrusting communities to identify their priorities and those milestones, not for the foundation or for Tammy and I to define these for them or prescribe their strategic priorities or milestones. So I think, again, we are supporting communities in this journey, and we're just excited to be partners in that endeavor.
So what do you know about these five communities we're going to soon have a presence in? What can you say at this early stage about their strengths and needs?
So the way I kind of think about it is, you know, as we were looking at all of the 20 proposals, there were kind of some markers that we were looking for. Obviously, one of the ones that we looked at was the size of the community. So we looked at population, and that was more of a, is it under 250,000 or not kind of thing. So it wasn't necessarily that was rated. It was more that it was just a relevant figure to kind of pay attention to. But there were things like percent population change over the last few years, or suicide rate, or number of firearm fatalities, or number of motor vehicle accidents. Many of the 20 that we looked at, and then specifically of the five that we chose, had very low rankings in the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation County Health Assessment. And it was striking. It was amazing to me that out of the 242 counties that reported, that we even had some that were at 241. So right. It was really helpful to have kind of some tangible numbers to look at. And then when we looked at their proposal and they told us stories about this, that gave it life. And that really let us know that, number one, we were looking for places where there was a strong hope to make change. And so I think that having that, we see that in each of these communities, and we're excited to be a part of that. I mean, I think it's so just cool to think that we can be there learning alongside them as they figure out how to make this work and how to make their communities healthier. And I think this is a real direction for mental health to go. And I think that's exciting. So
I would just add again, we looked at a variety of different markers and data sets, like those community demographics. We looked at those health rankings that Tammy referred to, an outstanding resource for all states and all communities. Also, since we are interested in health and wellness and well-being, we looked at health professional shortage areas and medically underserved areas, which are HRSA datas that are available online too. So we had many markers to help inform us and guide us in terms of identifying communities that had tremendous need, but also showed tremendous promise and opportunity.
And HRSA is Health Resources Services Administration.
Correct. Okay. Yes. Sorry for the acronym.
We love our acronyms around here. No problem.
Everybody does.
So as program officers, how are you prepared to be changed by your work with these new grantees?
Well, I think there's an obvious answer that Rick and I are going to be doing quite a bit of traveling.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself is significantly different than what we've done in the past and exciting. I think we all agree that we really like the person-to-person work.
Right.
And so I think that in general is exciting to us because it's that that standard cliche of we want to get our hands dirty. We want to be in the middle of something. We want to be helping and using whatever resources we have to really help these communities find their strengths. But I'll tell you that for me personally, as a consumer of mental health services and somebody that is always working on my own recovery, I'm really trying to pay particular attention to my emotional health in all of this, because I want to be as open as I can be in each of these environments. I want to be able to take in all of the information and be, I'm thinking of it kind of as a blank slate. I want to go into each community as non-judgmental as possible. And I get that we're all that way anyway. But I really want to try to suspend that as I go into each of these communities and learn what is happening and what has happened, learn from their history and learn from how they see themselves moving forward. Even though we've only had one meeting in a community, we're already seeing some of the tensions that have existed for years. And in order to really process that, I have to be open to feeling it. I have to be open to hearing it. I have to be open to people sharing different opinions with me than things I might readily see. And that can be emotionally exhausting. And so I need to build my own resiliency around that and make sure that I take really good care of myself so that I'm at my best self when I go into these communities.
For me, I think personally, I'm there to learn. This is one of the few times I don't have to be the expert. I'm kind of liking that. And I don't need to be the expert because we cannot be the experts of their communities. They are the experts of the communities. We bring tremendous expertise, those of us at the foundation. And then with the supports that we're going to be providing them through the coordinator and through the evaluation and learning team, I think we can really support their efforts to be successful. This is going to be challenging work, but we have every confidence that the communities that are selected for this initiative are dedicated 100% to achieving resiliency, mental health, and well-being for their communities. So we're excited to be a part of that.
Okay, so we are talking about our move into rural communities, the why, the how. key milestones that we're going to be looking for and how we ourselves expect to be changed as a result of doing this work. Tammy Hines, Rick Ibarra, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ike.
To learn more about what we're doing to support well-being in rural communities, if you go to our website, hogg.utexas.edu, under the News and Resources section at the top, if you scroll down and click News Releases, the most recent one is the announcement of the five grantee communities for the Well-Being in Rural Communities Initiative. You can find out a little bit more about their grant projects and what it is that they aim to accomplish. You'll be learning quite a bit more in the weeks and months to come. You might also be interested in our recent podcast episode with Dennis Mohat, an expert on mental health in rural communities. Dennis is Vice President for Behavioral Health at the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, and he's a former member of the Foundation's National Advisory Council. You can find that episode on our website by clicking on Podcast under the News and Resources section. Thank you so much for joining us.